Tell the American to move a little to the right, Gino replied, still peering into the viewfinder. A little to the right, commanded the Count in English, gesturing with the pistol, and Jake obeyed, for it brought him closer to his goal, but he was still shouting his protests. In the name of humanity and the International Red Cross, I shall radio Geneva today, the Count shouted back, to inquire of your credentials. Smile a little, Excellency, said Gino. The Count burst into a radiant smile and half turned towards the camera. Then I shall have you shot, he promised, still smiling. If you let this girl die, yelled Jake, it'll be the act of a barbarian. The smile vanished instantly, and the Count scowled darkly. And your actions, sir, are those of a spy. Enough talk. Surrender yourself. He lifted the pistol threateningly and aimed at the center of Jake's chest. Jake felt a chill of despair as he saw the big major reinforce the order by sliding the safety catch of his rifle to the fire position and pointing it at Jake's belly. At this critical moment, the driver's hatch of the armored car flew open with a clang that startled them all, and Vicky Camberwell rose to view, her blonde hair awry and her cheeks burning with anger. I am an accredited member of the American Press Association, she yelled as loudly as any of them, and I assure you that this outrage will be reported to the world in every detail. I warn you that... There was much more in this vein, and Vicky's anger was such that she could not remain still. She jumped up and down and flung her arms about in wild gesticulations, for the moment completely oblivious of the fact that she was bared to the waist. Her audience in the rolls was under no such illusion. Every man of them was a member of a nation whose favourite pastime was the adoration and pursuit of beautiful women, and every one of them considered himself to be the national champion. As Vicky's Bounty wobbled and swung and bounced with agitation, the four Italians gaped, half in disbelief and half in delight. The raised weapons sank and were forgotten. The Major attempted to rise to his feet in a gesture of chivalry, but was thrust firmly backwards by the Count. The driver's foot slipped off the clutch, and the rolls bucked violently and the engine stalled. Gino uttered an oath of approval, raised the camera, found the film was expended, swore again and opened the camera without taking his eyes off Vicky, dropped it from clumsy hands and abandoned it, grinning beatifically at this blonde vision. The Count began to raise his helmet, remembered he was now a warrior and with his other hand threw out a fascist salute. Found he was still gripping the pistol and did not have enough hands, so he held his helmet and the pistol to his chest with one hand. Madam, he said, dark eyes flashing, his voice taking on a romantic ring. My dear lady. At that moment, the Major tried again to rise, and the Count shoved him back into the seat once more, while Vicky continued her tirade with no diminution in fervour. Jake was completely forgotten by the Italians. He took four running steps and dived through the rear doors into the steel cab of the car. He rolled over and dropped Sarah into the space for the ammunition bins behind the driver's seat, and in a continuation of the same movement, he kicked the doors closed and turned the locking handle. Drive! He shouted at Vicky, although only her backside was visible as she stood on the driver's seat. Come on! And hauled her downwards, so that she sat with a thud on the hard leather seat, still shouting abuse at the enemy. Drive! Jake shouted, louder still. Get us out of here! The shocked dismay of the four Italians, as Vicky disappeared abruptly from view, like an inverted jack-in-a-box, lasted for many seconds and held them paralysed by disappointment. Then the armoured car's engine roared, and it bounded forward, straight at them, swinging broadside at the last moment. It hit the rolls only a glancing blow, crumpling the front mudguard and shattering the glass headlamp, before it tore off in its own dust storm towards the broken ground beyond the wells. Castellani was the first to act. He leapt to the ground and raced to reach the crank handle, shouting at the driver to start the engine. It fired at the first kick, and the Major sprang onto the running board. "Chase them!" he shouted in the driver's ear, brandishing his rifle, and once again the driver sprang the clutch, and the rolls leapt forward with such violence that the Count was tumbled backwards onto the soft leather seat. his helmet sliding forward over his eyes, his polished boots kicking to the skies, and his trigger finger tightening involuntarily. The Beretta fired with a vicious crack, and the bullet flew an inch past Gino's ear, so that he fell to the floorboards on top of his camera and whimpered with fright. "Faster!" shouted the Major in the driver's ear. "Hit them off! Force them to turn!" And his voice was louder and more authoritative. He wanted a clean shot at the few vulnerable points in the car's armour, the driver's visor or the open gun mounting. "Stop!" screeched the Count. "I'll have you shot for this!" Side by side, the two vehicles pitched and lurched together like a team in harness, not 10 feet separating them. Within the armoured car, Vicky's vision through the visor was limited to a narrow arc ahead, and she concentrated on that as she shouted, "Where are they?" Jake picked himself out of the corner, where he and Sarah had been thrown, and crawled towards the command turret. In the rolls alongside, Castellani braced himself and raised the rifle. Even at that close range, 5 of his 6 shots struck the thick steel hull with a ringing sledgehammer blow and went whining away across the desert spaces. Only 1 bullet entered the narrow breech of the gun mounting. Trapped within the hull, it ricocheted among the 3 of them like an angry living thing, splattering them with stinging slivers of lead and bringing death within inches before it ploughed into the back of the driver's seat. Jake popped his head out of the turret and discovered the rolls running hard beside them, the burly Major frantically reloading his empty rifle, and the other passengers bouncing around helplessly. "Driver!" shouted Jake. "Hard right!" and felt a quick flush of pride and affection as Vicky responded instantly. She swung the great armoured hull so suddenly that the other driver had no time to respond. The 2 vehicles came together with a shower of bright white sparks and a thunderous grinding crash. "Save us, Mother of God!" shrieked the Count. "We are killed!" The rolls reeled under the impact, shearing off and losing ground, her paintwork deeply scarred and her whole side dented and torn. Castellani had leapt nimbly into the back seat at the last possible moment, avoiding having his legs crushed by the collision, and now he'd reloaded the rifle. "Closer!" he shouted at the driver. "Give me another shot at her!" But the Count had at last recovered his balance and pushed his helmet onto the back of his head. "Stop, you fool!" His voice was clear and urgent. "You'll kill us all!" And the driver braked with patent relief, smiling for the first time that day. "Keep going, you idiot!" said Castellani sternly, and placed the muzzle of the rifle to the driver's ear hole. His smile switched off, and his foot fell heavily on the pedal again. "Stop!" said the Count, as he dragged himself up again, adjusted his helmet with 1 hand, and placed the muzzle of the Beretta pistol in the driver's vacant ear hole. "I, your colonel, command you!"
"Keep going!" growled Castellani.
And the driver closed his eyes tightly, not daring to move his head, and roared straight at the ramparts of red earth that guarded the wadi. In the moment before the rolls ploughed headlong into a wall of sun-baked earth, the driver's dilemma was resolved for him. Gregorius, for lack of another ally, had appeared to his grandfather's warrior instincts, and, despite the vast quantities of tej that he'd drunk, that ancient had responded nobly. Gathering his bodyguard about him and outstripping them in the race down the wadi, only Gregorius himself kept pace with the tall, gangling figure as he ran down to the plain. The 2 of them came out side by side and found the rolls and the white-painted armoured car bearing down on them at point-blank range in a storm of dust. It was a sight to daunt the bravest heart, and Gregorius died for the shelter of the red earth ramparts. But the Ras had killed his lion and did not flinch. He flung up the trusty old Martini Henry rifle. The explosion of black powder sounded like a cannon shot. A vast cloud of blue smoke blossomed and a long red flame shot from the barrel. The windscreen of the rolls exploded in a silver burst of flying glass splinters, one of which nicked the Count's chin.
"Holy Mary, I'm killed!" cried the Count,
and the driver needed nothing further to tip his allegiance. He swung the rolls into a tight, roaring U-turn, and not all of Castellani's threats could deter him. It was enough. He could take no more. He was going home.
"My God!"
breathed Jake, as he watched the battered rolls swinging tightly away and then gathering speed as it accelerated back towards the ridge, the arms and weapons of its occupants still waving wildly, and their voices raised in loud, hysterical argument that faded with distance. The Rass's cannon boomed again, speeding them on their way, and Vicky slowed the car as they came up to him. Jake reached down and helped the ancient gentleman aboard. His eyes were bloodshot and he smelled like an abandoned brewery, but his wizened old face was crinkled into a wicked grin of satisfaction.
"How do you do?"
he asked, with evident relish. "Not bad, sir," Jake assured him. "Not bad at all." A little before noon, the formation of armoured cars parked in the open grassland 20 miles beyond the wells. A halt had been called there to allow the straggling mass of refugees that had escaped the slaughter at Chaldi to come up with them, and this was the first opportunity that Vicky had to work on Syra's leg. It had stiffened in the last hour, and the blood had clotted into a thick, dark scab. Though Syra made no protest, she had paled to a muddy colour and was sweating in tiny beads across her forehead and upper lip as Vicky cleaned the wound and poured half a bottle of peroxide into it. Vicky sought to distract her as she worked by bringing up the subject of the dead they'd left scattered about the waterholes under the Italian guns. Syra shrugged philosophically. "Hundreds die every day of sickness and hunger, and from the fighting in the hills. They die without purpose or reason. These others have died for a purpose. They have died to tell the world about us." And she broke off and gasped as the disinfectant boiled in the wound. "I'm sorry," said Vicky quickly. "It is nothing," she said. And they were quiet for a while. Then Syra asked, "You will write it, won't you, Miss Camberwell?"
"Sure,"
Vicky nodded grimly.
"I'll write it good.
Where can I find a telegraph office?"
"There is one at Sardi,"
Syra told her,
"at the railway office."
"What I write will burn out their lines for them," promised Vicky, and began to bind up the leg with a linen bandage from the medicine chest.
"We'll have to get those breeches off you."
Vicky inspected the blood-stained and tattered velvet dubiously.
"They're so tight, it's a wonder you haven't given yourself gangrene." "They must be worn so," Syra explained. "It was decreed by my great-grandfather, Ras Ulbai."
"Good Lord," Vicky was intrigued. "What on earth for?"
"The ladies in those days were very naughty," Syra explained primly, "and my great-grandfather was a good man. He thought to make the breeches difficult to remove."
Vicky laughed delightedly.
"Do you think it helps?"
she demanded, still laughing.
"Oh, no." Syra shook her head seriously. "It makes it very hard."
She spoke with the air of an expert, and then thought for a moment.
"They come down quickly enough. It's when you want to get them up again in a hurry. That can be very difficult."
"Well, the only way we're going to get you out of these now is to cut you loose." Vicky was still smiling, as she took a large pair of scissors from the medicine chest, and Syra shrugged again with resignation.
"They were very pretty before Jake tore them. Now it does not matter."
And she showed no emotion as Vicky snipped carefully along the seam and peeled them off her. "Now you must rest." Vicky wrapped her naked lower body in a woolen chamois and helped her settle comfortably on one of the thin coir mattresses spread on the floor of the car.
"Stay with me?" Syra asked shyly, as Vicky picked up her portable typewriter
and would have climbed out of the rear doors. "I must begin my dispatch."
"You can work here. I will be very quiet."
"Promise?"
"I promise."
And Vicky opened the case and placed the typewriter in her lap, sitting cross-legged. She wound a sheet of fresh paper into the machine and thought for a moment. Then her fingers flew at the keys. Almost instantly, the anger and outrage returned to her and was transferred smoothly into words and hammered out on the thin sheet of yellow paper. Vicky's cheeks flamed with colour, and she tossed her head occasionally to keep the tendrils of fine blonde hair out of her eyes. Sarah watched her, keeping very still and silent, until Vicky paused to wind a fresh sheet into the typewriter. Then she broke the silence.
"I have been thinking, Miss Camberwell."
"You have?" Vicky did not look up.
"I think it should be Jake."
"Jake?" Vicky glanced at her, baffled by this sudden shift in thought.
"Yes,"
Sarah nodded with finality.
"We will take Jake as your first lover."
She made it sound like a group project.
"Oh, we will we?"
The idea had already entered Vicky's head and was almost firmly rooted, but she balked instantly at Sarah's bold statement.
"He is so strong, yes," Sarah went on. "I think we will definitely take Jake."
And with that statement, she dashed as low as they'd ever been the chances of Jake Barton. Vicky snorted derisively and flew at the typewriter once again. She was a lady who liked to make her own decisions. The river of moving men and animals flowed wedge-shaped across the sparsely grassed and rolling landscape beneath the mountains. Over it all hung a fine mist of dust, like sea fret on a windy day, and the sunlight caught and flashed from the burnished surfaces of the bronze war shields and the lifted lance tips. Closer came the mass of riders, until the bright spots of the silk chamois of the officers and noblemen showed clearly through the loom of the dust cloud. Standing on the turret of Priscilla the pig, Jake shaded the lens of his binoculars with his helmet and tried to see beyond the dust clouds, searching anxiously for any pursuit by the Italians. He felt goose flesh march up his arms and tickle the thick hair at the nape of his neck, as he imagined this sprawling rabble caught in a crossfire of modern machine guns, and he fretted for the arrival of their own weapons, which were lost somewhere amongst that ragged army. He felt a touch on his shoulder and turned quickly to find Lige Mikhail beside him.
"Thank you, Mr. Barton,"
said the prince quietly, and Jake shrugged and turned back to his scrutiny of the distant plains.
"It was not the correct thing, but I thank you all the same."
"How is she?"
"I've just left her with Miss Camberwell. She is resting, and I think she will be well."
They were silent a while longer before Jake spoke again. "I'm worried, Prince. We're wide open. If the Italians chase now, it'd be a bloody murder.
Where are the guns? We must have the guns."
Lige Mikhail pointed out onto the left rear flank of the approaching host. "There." And Jake noticed for the first time the ungainly shapes of the pack camels, almost obscured by dust and distances, but standing taller than the shaggy little Harari ponies that surrounded them, and lumbering solidly onwards towards where the cars waited. "They will be here in half an hour." Jake nodded with relief. He began planning how he would arm the cars immediately, so that they could be deployed to counter another Italian attack. But the prince interrupted his thoughts.
"Mr. Barton, how long have you known Major Swales?"
Jake lowered the glasses and grinned. "Sometimes I think too long," and regretted it, as he noticed the prince's immediate anxiety. "No, I didn't mean that. It was a bad joke. I haven't known him long."
"We checked his record very carefully before..." He hesitated.
"Before tricking him into taking on this commission," Jake suggested, and the prince smiled faintly and nodded.
"Precisely," he agreed. "All the evidence suggests that he is an unscrupulous man, but a skilled soldier, with a proven record of achievement in training raw recruits. He is an expert weapons instructor, with a full knowledge of the mechanism and exploitation of modern weapons."
The prince paused. "Just don't get into a card game with him."
"I will take your advice, Mr. Barton."
The prince smiled fleetingly, and then was serious again. Miss Camberwell called him a coward. That is not so. He was acting under my direct orders, as a soldier should.
Point taken, grinned Jake. But then, I'm not a soldier, only a grease monkey. But the prince brushed the disclaimer aside.
He's probably a better man than he thinks he is, said Jake.
And the prince nodded.
His combat record in France is impressive. The military cross, and 3 times mentioned in dispatches.
Yeah, you have me convinced, murmured Jake.
Is that what you wanted?
No, admitted the prince reluctantly. I had hoped that you might convince me.
And they both laughed.
And did you check my record also? Jake asked.
No, admitted the prince. The first time I ever heard of you was in Dar es Salaam. You and your strange machines were a bonus, a surprise packet.
The prince paused again,
and then spoke so softly that Jake barely caught the words.
And perhaps the best end of the bargain.
Then he lifted his chin and looked steadily into Jake's eyes.
The anger is still with you, he said. I can see how strong it is.
With surprise, Jake realized that the prince was correct. The anger was in him. No longer the leaping flames that had kindled at the first shock of the atrocity. Those had burned down into a thick, glowing bed in the pits of his guts. But the memory of men and women, caught by the guns and the mortars, would sustain that glow for a long time ahead.
I think now you are committed to us,
the Lidge went on softly. Now Jake was amazed at the man's perception. He'd not yet recognized that commitment himself. For the first time since he'd landed in Africa, he was motivated by something outside himself. He knew that he would stay now, and that he would fight with the Lidge and these people as long as they needed him. In an intuitive flash, he realized that if these simple people were enslaved, then all of mankind, including Jake Barton, were themselves deprived of a measure of freedom. A line almost forgotten, imperfectly learned long ago, and not then understood, surfaced in his memory.
No man is an island, he said. And the Lidge nodded and continued the quotation.
Entire of itself. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind.
The Lidge's dark eyes glowed. Yes, Mr. Barton.
John Donne. I think that in you I have been lucky. You are fire, and Gareth Swales is ice. It will work for me. Already there is a bond between you.
A bond?
And Jake laughed. A brief, harsh bark of laughter, but then stopped and thought about the prince's words. The man had even greater perception than Jake had at first realized. He had a knack of turning over unrecognized truths.
Yes, a bond, said the Lidge. Fire and ice. You will see.
They were silent for a while, standing high on the steel turret of the car, bareheaded in the sun, each man thinking his own thoughts. Then the Lidge roused himself and turned to point into the west.
There is the heart of Ethiopia, he said. The mountains.
They both lifted their heads to the soaring peaks and the great flat-topped ambers that characterized the Ethiopian highlands. Each tableland was divided from the next by sheer walls of riven rock, blue with distance and remote as the clouds, into which they seemed to rise, and by the deep, dark gorges that looked to split the earth like the axe stroke of a giant, plunging thousands upon thousands of feet to the swiftly raging torrents in their depths.
The mountains protect us. For 100 miles on each side, no enemy may pass.
The prince swept his arms wide to encompass the curving blue wall of rock that faded both north and south into the smoky distances where they merged with the paler bright blue of the sky.
But there is the Sardi Gorge.
Jake saw it cleave the wall of mountains, a deep funnel driving into the rock,
perhaps 15 miles across at its widest point, but then narrowing swiftly and climbing steeply towards the distant heights. "The Sadi Gorge," the prince said, a lance pointed into the exposed flank of the Lion of Judah. He shook his head, and his expression was troubled, and once again that haunted, hunted look was in his eyes. "The Emperor Negusa Nagast, Haile Selassie, has gathered his armies in the north, 150,000 men, to meet the main thrust of the Italians, which must come from the north, out of Eritrea and through Adowa. The Emperor's flanks are secured by the mountains, except here, at the gorge. This is the only place at which a modern, mechanized army might win its way to the high ground. The road up the gorge is steep and rough, but the Italians are engineering masters. Their road-making wizardry dates back to the Caesars. If they force the mouth of the gorge, they could have 50,000 men on the highlands inside of a week." He punched his fist upwards towards the far blue peaks. "They would be across the Emperor's rear between him and the capital at Addis Ababa, with the road to the city wide open to them. It would be the end for us. And the Italians know it. Their presence here at the wells of Chaldi prove it. What we encountered there today was the advance guard of the enemy attack, which will come through the gorge." "Yeah," Jake agreed. "It seems that is so. The Emperor has charged me with the defense of the Sadli Gorge," said the prince quietly. "But at the same time he has ordained that the great bulk of my fighting men must join his army, which is now gathering on the shores of Lake Tana, 200 miles away in the west. We will be short of men, so short that without your cars and the new machine guns you have brought to me, the task would be impossible."
"That isn't going to be a pushover, even with these beaten-up old ladies."
"I know that, Mr. Barton, and I am doing everything in my power to improve the betting in our favor. I'm even treating with a traditional enemy of the Harari to form a common front against the enemy. I'm trying to put aside old feuds and convince the Ras of the Galas to join us in the defense of the gorge. The man is a robber and a degenerate, and his men are all shifter, mountain bandits, but they fight well, and every lance now arms us against the common enemy." Jake was conscious of the faith that the prince was placing in him. He was being treated like a trusted commander, and his newly realized sense of involvement was strengthened.
"An untrustworthy friend is the worst kind of enemy."
"I don't recognize that quotation," the prince inquired.
"Jake Barton, mechanic." Jake grinned at him. "Looks like we got ourselves a job of work. What I want to do is pick out some of your really bright lads. Ones I can teach to drive a car. Or men that Gareth can use as gunners."
"Yes, I have already discussed that with Major Swells. He made the same suggestion. I will handpick my best for you."
"Young ones," said Jake, "who'll learn quickly."
The Ras sat, crouched like an ancient vulture, in the strip of shade thrown by Gareth's car, the hump. His eyes were narrowed, like those of a sniper, and he mumbled to himself, drooling a little with excitement. When Gregorius reached out and tried to view the fan of cards that the Ras still secretly held to his bosom, his hand was slapped away angrily, and a storm of Amaric burst about him. Gregorius was justly put out of countenance by this, for he was, after all, his grandfather's interpreter. He complained to Gareth, who squatted opposite the Ras, holding his own cards carefully against the front of his tweed jacket.
"He does not want me to help him any more," protested Gregorius. "He says he understands the game now."